Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Thank you for joining us for episode 6 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So as for announcements this week,
we're going to keep it brief.
Quite brief. First, not really an announcement, but a birthday wish. Happy, happy belated birthday to Katrina Balfe, our Claire.
I'm sure she's appropriately aged. I don't even know what year to say her, but, you know, I'm sure she looks great for her, whatever the age is.
I think she's in her 30s. Am I wrong? No, she's in her 30s.
I think they're both in their 30s.
They're both in their 30s, yeah.
But she looks fantastic as always.
She looks amazing. She looks timeless.
Timeless.
Like Claire does. Happy birthday, Katrina.
Happy birthday. And in other news, I would like to personally thank everyone who voted.
Yay!
Who voted in the Stars. Well, I don't know if it wasn't really a contest. It was like
It was a poll or a vote.
To what we as fans would like to be called. And they didn't give us a margin.
No.
But
you can see the margin all the way up until the day of the
voting was
done.
Correct. But once it closed, I don't know what the actual margin was for when it closed. But I'm delighted to say that we all overwhelmingly chose to be called Outlanders.
Yes, I must say I am very happy.
Well, it's perfect. It's simple. It doesn't have a lot of extra words in it. And it's applicable for a man or a woman.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I think it just encompasses a perfect fandom name.
Through the magic of technology, Scottish folk singer Ailey Grant joined us in studio for a wee chat. Those of you not familiar with Ailey and her music, you're in for a treat.
We wanted to say thank you so much, Ailey Grant, for joining us today out of your busy, busy schedule. We know that we already knew you were going to be quite busy, but we did see on Twitter this morning that just how busy you were. Returning from a gig in England at approximately 4 a.m. your time.
I did actually make good time and I got home for about 2:15. So nice and cozy in my bed, thank goodness.
Good. So you were able to get a little bit of sleep at least.
A little bit, yes. Until the kids got up at 7.
I was like, they're not going to let her sleep long.
That's true. The wee ones will always find you.
I know. We did have the option of staying down, but to see their faces in the morning,
yes.
I'd give up all my lions for that, really.
Well, that's, again, it's so great to have you here with us. And I guess we want to start with a little bit more about you. We want to talk about your music, of course, but a little bit about your family life. In your upbringing, do you come from a musical family?
Well, first and foremost, I have to say thank you very much for inviting me to have this conversation with you. I'm delighted. Yes, I do come from a musical family, from many generations back, but from many different influences. And it's mainly my father who is the main folk influence in my life. He took us around lots of folk festivals and folk clubs around Scotland. And me and my three brothers were trailed around. But it was really myself who fell in love with the music and have continued it.
Excellent. And I was reading some of your bio on your website as well. And I had read that your parents came from opposite sides of Scotland. And that you had three brothers. And I was just wondering if you indeed had any, if you or your brothers had any influence from your family. So that's nice to hear, musically speaking.
So, yes. I mean, you've obviously been in Scotland. So you know that each area in Scotland, because it was all very close-knit communities, they developed their own language of sorts. Mm-hmm. And my dad, he's from Aberdeen, and he has the Doric, which is another dialect in Scotland, which unfortunately I can't really speak, but I can sing and I can understand it. But it's really, it's quite funny to listen to. It's very sing-songy and beautiful and very humorous at the same time. And my mum, she was brought up in Paisley. And so she's got a very West Coast accent. So I have a mix of everything. I can't really place me in Scotland. So, no, I try and draw on that for my music.
That's wonderful. And you also, I also read that you were, besides being going around with your family and going to different festivals and folk clubs, that you actually took part in drama performances as well as musical theater. How did you like that as a child or growing up?
Well, I was very shy as a child, and I know that my parents would think that's a lie. I'm probably laughing for saying that, but because I was, you know, being the only girl in a family of mainly boys, I kind of had to make my voice heard. When I started doing drama, theatre work, it really brought me out of my shell. It gave me the confidence on stage that I didn't have before, and I like to still dive into the whole musical songs. It feels very like home to me. It just gave me the confidence, and you know, I fell in love with the stage at that point, because the idea of getting on stage and almost bearing your soul was terrifying to me. But I started off with small steps and was able to sing in front of people, and then slowly I've been able to talk in front of people on stage. So that's the I hate the most is actually the talking to people.
The patter is always the hardest thing, like when you're doing a cabaret show or anything. Yes. I always felt like singing is the easy part, because especially if you didn't write it, then you're bearing someone else's soul.
So yes, you can imagine where the song, you know, why the song was written. Right. So it's again, that was how I learned from, you know, what I learned from the stage and musicals, is to take other people's work and really feel the music and you know, act it out, because before you know it, you know, everything about you is in the song, and you can make it your own.
So Ailey, looking at your CD and the selections you chose to include, it speaks of a good mix of either experience or influence, from Burns to folk, from folk music from all over the English speaking world, as well as a little bit of tango. Did I hear?
Yes,
you did. That tango.
Yes, that was tango.
Oh my goodness! And that was written by yourself, correct?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is like, it's such a little, it's just, you don't expect it. And then that song comes on and you're like, whoa, okay then. that was Nothing to You, correct?
Yes, Nothing to You, yes.
Nothing to You, the song that you wrote, yes. Very, very tango-esque, and I thought it stood out very nicely and gave kind of a different pop to the middle of the album. different sound, a kind of a very unique sound coming from all this folk and Joni Mitchell, and then tango. I thought it was a nice mix.
Well, I'm glad. Thank you.
And speaking of that, my guess is that that selection reflects at least some of the influences that you've had. Could you speak to your musical influences?
I can. Really, it's mainly my family, first and foremost. I live currently on the border of North Ayrshire and Renfrewshire. And North Ayrshire is where Robert Burns was born and bred. And this whole area is steeped in Burns music. And I have a real passion for Burns music. You know, in 1,000 years' time, his words will still be relevant. And it really just stirs something in you, I think, throughout the world. I mean, Auld Lang Syne is, you know, sang, you know, every New Year. And it really does tug at the heartstrings. And I couldn't, you know, do an album without that in it. And for my dad's side, he loves American music, and especially American folk music. And one of the songs on the album is written by Kate McGarrigle. It's a beautiful song, Talk to Me of Mendocino.
Summer and I we have to talk to you about that in a little bit. We both separately and then came together just about a little earlier today to talk about to mention, because we didn't want to spoil it for ourselves, for each other. And so that was actually, we both said that was our favorite one.
One of our favorites, yeah.
I'm glad. One of the other influences is obviously Joni Mitchell. Mm-hmm. When I was 18, 19, I heard the song A Case of You for the first time and utterly fell in love with Joni Mitchell at that point, which everyone does, really, because that is, Blue Album is just amazing. And I was determined to get up on the stage and sing that, and I performed it with my father. And the moment I sang that on stage, I knew instantly that for the rest of my life I wanted to be doing exactly that, standing on stage and singing and feeling everything. It was just one of those pivotal moments in your life, and it was just amazing. And the first song on the album is a song called I Wish It Was in Glasgow, which was written by Billy Connolly, the comedian and actor. And first and foremost, he was a musician, or still is a musician, and a fantastic banjo player. And I've been singing that song since I was about three with my younger brother, Stephen. And my dad recorded it and sent it off to Billy Connolly. Oh. And he wrote a wee letter back to my brother, really, because at that point I sang so high that only dogs could hear me. So they didn't hear me. But I couldn't do an album without that. I mean, the album, it's my first one, and I had to make sure that it reflects my past, my present, and what I would like to do in the future. So hopefully it's a nice balance of where I'd like to progress and being sentimental at the same time.
You just described how the moment you realized what you wanted to do with the rest of your life when you were on stage singing with your father.
Mm-hmm.
What? That was in, was it 2002?
I think it was just about that, yes.
Okay, so that was definitely before you took part in Celtic Connection in 2004.
Yes.
And you won the Danny Kyle Award for that.
Yes.
For that. What did you do? What did you perform at Celtic Connection?
Well, Danny Kyle was a gentleman who was Billy Connolly's best friend, and he sadly passed away long before he should have. And I knew him quite well as a child. My dad was good friends with him, and he was such a lovely man. And so they set up every year the Danny Kyle Awards, and artists from all over the world applied to get into the competition.
Oh, wow.
And in the end, it gets whittled down. And for the 2 weeks that Celtic Connections is on, there's like five performances. And then from that, they then pick six winners. And they get to perform big stages in the next year. So it's really good. A good laugh at the same time.
So
you do hear some weird and wonderful music.
It sounds like it. And so you were able to, it wasn't just, okay, I perform once and you find out. It was actually a whittling down of performance.
Yes.
So that's it's exciting, but also any kind of competition that doesn't just happen on a day can be even more of an adrenaline rush if it takes you over days or weeks.
It does, yes. I remember getting the phone call and to say that I'd won, and you could have said I'd won an Oscar, to be honest. I was delighted.
Well, who knows? One day, maybe for best songwriting or best music, or best song. You never know.
You never know.
You never know. And also to follow that up, you after your release of Masks and Smiles, your debut album, you also won the Scottish New Music Award for Best Folk or Traditional Recording of the Year.
Yes,
in 2011. How was that?
That was funny. It was surreal. There was an award ceremony that me and my husband got dressed up for, and off we went. It was not long after my son Drury had been born. And it was quite an experience, and I didn't expect to win because I was up against some amazing people, but lo and behold, they called my name and I went and accepted my award and was on cloud nine for about 3 years after that.
Oh gosh, yeah, you're probably still on it. I would still be on cloud nine. To have it your first run out on your first album is quite extraordinary.
Yes, I mean, it was, you do bear your soul when you record, and to have that appreciated, and it is quite reassuring, and knowing that you're doing the right thing.
What are your ideas, or have you had any ideas, especially given the popularity or resurgence, if you will, of Welsh in Wales and Irish in Ireland and the Gaelic in Scotland? Mm-hmm. Have you sung in Gaelic, or are you planning on it?
I have sung in Gaelic, but being from the central belt of Scotland, I didn't get brought up with the Gaelic. But Glasgow, which is the city I live nearest, it's a major hub for Gaelic speakers. Mm-hmm. And I'm working with a sort of all-female sort of Scottish girl band, if you will. And one of the girls is a Gaelic speaker, and so she's introduced Gaelic singing to us. So I've delved into it now, I can say. I wasn't sure about it at first, because it's some of the Gaelic singers can be quite territorial. They want it spoken exactly as it should, and obviously if you're not a native speaker of it, you can make mistakes, which can rile them a wee bit, so I was a bit worried about it, but I've given it a go, and so far so good.
Well, that sounds exciting.
Yes, it is exciting, but most of the stuff I haven't a clue what I'm singing. Of course, my name is Gaelic.
Yes.
But it's Gaelic for Helen, but, you know, apart from Cymru, I don't really speak it at all.
Yeah, it's a beautiful language.
It is. I mean, it's a complicated one as well.
Yes, that is true.
Just very unusual and beautiful at the same time, which is why it's such a pleasure to sing it, because, you know, it's so ancient and lovely.
That it is. So, Ailey, you have thought about a song you would like us to include today. And can you share with listeners what that song was?
The song is a Robert Burns song, and it's a beautiful song called The Lyric. It's a very romantic little song, but it's one of my favourite from the album, mainly because it has the fiddles in the start and an instrumental piece. Fiddles give me shivers down my spine every time I hear it, because it sounds like a full orchestra, and it's just lovely. So I hope the listeners enjoy it.
I drove an Airbnb.
That was beautiful. Is there anything you'd like to tell the listeners or to follow that up with?
Yes, a little interesting story about when that was being recorded. The fiddle player was very drunk. And it's when he plays best.
Is he going to hear this, Ailey?
I don't know.
Well, don't tell him, we won't tell him.
So you're saying if you hire him that you should definitely give him a beer before you start recording?
Okay, I will. Don't worry about that.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Oh, it was recorded about 3 a.m. and then,
oh, well. Well, so, yeah, then you kind of need it.
Yes, I'd gone to bed long before that, so he carried on. And,
oh, gosh.
And when I heard it in the morning and heard that he had been drinking, I was like, what?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I heard it and I was like, well, you should drink more often because that's brilliant.
Would you like, you've already given us that. This is just a question. We don't have to include this part. And mm-hmm. You don't have to answer. Would you like to give a shout out to your fiddler?
Yes, he is the wonderful Rudy Campbell. a lovely guy. I've known him for many years. And he was on stage when I won my Danny Kyle Award. So.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. We're just looking at the back. We're looking at the back of your insert. And he's the Rory.
Rudy.
Rudy.
Ruri. It means Red King. So it's basically ginger.
Basically ginger. Well, there you go. Hey, now. I should just call myself Ruri.
Ruri, yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's it. That's definitely, that's a one-off here at the Outlander Pod Studio. Oh, we have to ask. Since okay. It has been, and I understand you're still, as you put on Twitter, and as you've told us, and we've discussed a little bit about, you just got back from a gig in England, so you are definitely still performing. You're still performing your heart out. Is a next album in the works?
Yes, several projects really. The main one I'd like to work on is a totally Burns album. So I can pick and choose from a wealth of songs, and I'm really excited about working on that. Plus, the band that I'm with, the Celtic Quines, the Scottish group, we hopefully will be recording an album in the new year, which would be very good. We've done a few demos. What I hope to do is upload a few of the demo songs. One of them is a Gaelic song for you guys to hear later on.
Oh, excellent. And so Summer and I fell in love with Talk to Me of Mendocino. And I looked up Kate McGarrigle and Kate and Anna. And it was a song that Kate wrote that about their cross-country drive in the U.S. And they had actually spent some time in Mendocino. And I also read about Kate's tragic death. So that was the song itself is beautiful, but when you read it against, even though it was written years before she died, it just it just makes it that much more poignant.
It does. And I was in touch with the sisters before I recorded the song. And unfortunately, Kate didn't get to hear it in time, but Anna McGarrigle did. And she said that she loved it and her sister would love it as well. But before Kate got to hear it, she sadly passed away. So, which is sad, but I'm quite proud of that one. I do like that one. And I'm glad you guys do too.
Oh, very much so. As you were putting together selections for your album, what drew you, besides the fact that it was folk music, what drew you to Talk to Me of Mendocino?
Well, each song on the album does have a story behind it. So it's not randomly put on the album. Mm. That one in particular, my dad was singing it. And this is when many years ago when I was staying with my dad. My dad likes to play the guitar and sing at like 11 o'clock at night. And I kept hearing him trying to sing this song over and over and over. And by the time I got so frustrated, I think I'd been listening to him sing for about 2 hours, this song, but he was not getting it. And I stormed downstairs and I said, play it again. And so he did. And I sang it to him. And just from that moment on, I just fell in love with this song and I was like,
And we did note a case of you. We both noted that. So that was very nice.
Well, that's hands down my favorite Joni Mitchell song of like all time.
Yeah. That's her. Yeah.
That's a Little Green. That one breaks my heart every time I sing it. It's such a tragic song in itself, especially after you hear what Joni Mitchell's been through in her life.
Well, Joni Mitchell is hard to sing because she's got such a range.
She does. She's very rangy.
She sings so low, like in almost mannish. And then she can hit these like very lyrically high notes in the same song. And it just, it's mind boggling to me.
Yeah. And her, when she plays guitar, she has so many different tunings of the guitar. It's just incredible what this woman can do. And she can paint.
We are so thankful that we were able to chat with you today. Is there, as we begin to wrap up, we'd like to ask you questions we call quirky questions. Questions that hopefully are not always asked of you in interviews.
Right, okay.
What was your worst subject in high school?
Maths.
What was your best subject in high school?
Art. I loved art. It was very therapeutic. I also enjoyed music, obviously. But definitely art. I like to be creative, so. But I'm not the best drawer in the family. I've got three brothers. My oldest brother, he's Jamie. He is fantastic at art. And my middle brother, Gordon, he's very good as well, but in a different kind of way. He's actually a DJ at the moment. He works at the Ministry of Sound in London. I don't know if that's something you're familiar with. But it's one of the sort of major places in the world for DJ music that he does, like sketches and things like that. So he's quite good at that. But being third in line, the talent seemed to dwindle a wee bit. But I still enjoy it. I like making things. I like designing clothes and making the clothes. So yeah, art, definitely art.
Excellent.
If you had to eat one meal for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, goodness me. I love food. venison. I adore venison. It is heaven on a plate. And if you ever come back, then you need to go to the Isle of Jura, and where they have far more deer than they do people.
Wow.
It's you get venison for everything, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's amazing. It's just amazing. Oh, and cheese. Can I put cheese in that as well?
You
cheese.
Can put anything on the plate.
It can be like a venison cheeseburger.
Yeah, venison cheeseburger. No, I love food. I'm definitely a meat eater.
And what to drink? Because we're talking about a meal, so it can include a drink.
Well, I'm sitting here with a glass of wine, so a lovely glass of red wine, a nice Cote de Rhone or something like that. Definitely. Not a huge fan of whiskey, I'm afraid. My husband is, though. But I'll stick to the red wine.
And finally, what was your childhood nickname?
Embarrassing one.
It doesn't have to be embarrassing.
Those are the best ones.
They're the best, but...
Well, I've got two stories about my name.
That too.
My parents took a long time to decide what my name would be, and eventually settled on Ailey. But my parents decided to let the honour of giving my middle name to my brother Jamie, who, as I said, he's 10 years older than me. So he went away and he thought about it really hard. And he came back with the choice of Anne, which is a lovely name, but it makes alien. Is that it?
Oh, gosh.
I know, it's awful, isn't it? So my, you know, a really subtle, very subtle way of... my parents didn't realise until I was about three, my aunt's new boyfriend came in the house and said, "Do you realise your daughter's alien Grant?" So that's the first story about my name. My other one is my younger brother, Stephen. He was very good at making up rhymes, and he came up with the nickname Ailey Bailey Chapa Belly. So forever and a day, I have been called Chapa by my dad, and I still put that down to my parents' divorce because my dad would call me Chapa and it would drive my mum batty. So yeah, my nickname's Chapa. It's not very glamorous or complimentary, but... He still won't. My brother still won't tell me why he called me that. But I'm still thinking of a good nickname for him.
So, are you still called Chapa?
Occasionally by my dad. But not so much anyone else. Ales is what I get mainly. Ales. And I'm sure we'll obviously be having conversations in the run up to the series.
Oh my goodness! Yes, we will.
Well, I've been. My husband hates me. I think sometimes when I read the books, I think I'm on like fourth round of them.
Oh no! Okay, so you're old hat too. Then you're like been there, done that. I know.
Yeah, I think I found them from a friend who's an American. Actually, she came over and she said, "Have you read these books?" I'm like, "No, no, I've never heard of them." Which seems to be the way of it in Scotland, and. So I started reading it and just fell instantly in love with the whole thing. And
we met virtually through the series, obviously. But so much, I mean, it's just so many things that potentially never would have come together are coming together, and it's so exciting.
Yes, it is. It's very exciting, and seeing people fall in love with Scotland through this book is amazing.
It is,
and. It really makes me as a Scottish girl really appreciative of what I've got around me.
So, Ailey, what's the best way for listeners to get in touch with you or find out more about your music?
Well, first and foremost, the best place to go is my website, which is www.aileygrant.com. The spelling is, obviously it's Gaelic, so it makes no sense whatsoever, is E-I-L-I-D-H. Grant is obviously G-R-A-N-T, and but I'm mainly on Twitter nowadays. I think it's Ailey_Grant. I'm on Facebook as well, Ailey Grant.
Ailey, thank you so much for spending part of your Sunday evening with us, and it was a joy to be able to speak with you and chat.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it too, and I hope we get to speak again soon and maybe get to meet in person.
I was about to say, don't say that, but we have wood in front of us. Yes, I'll knock on wood. Yes, that would be amazing.
Well, I hope you all did your homework and read chapters 1 and 2, because if not, A, you're behind, and B, you may or may not be spoiled by what's about to occur right now.
We're going to do our best not to spoil anything outside of the 2 chapters, or I should say, outside of any chapters we will discuss.
We should get a buzzer.
To buzz each other?
To buzz each other. Like if somebody starts veering off in other chapters, they're going to be like,
In case it gets too spoilery or too buzzery, people may turn us off. So
well, then we'll
maybe
get like
no
a pleasant
buzzer.
One that's like ding dong or some pleasant noise, wind chimes.
That's actually not a bad idea.
Well, maybe we'll work on that for next week. So let's just get straight to the read-along. Chapters 1 and 2.
So basically, in this chunk, and we'll talk about the 2 chapters together, we are introduced to Claire and Frank and a number of others. And we see that they're both English. Claire is an army nurse, or she was a nurse in World War II. And Frank is a historian, a trained historian, and was conscripted or became an officer during the war and then joined MI6. So there's some intelligence training there.
Which kind of leads to the fact that when he was conscripted, they kind of went, you're really smart. Let's keep you out of the infantry. Or maybe strength is not your strong suit. Let's put you in the brain trust, if you will.
And the two are in the Scottish Highlands doing their best for the intention of having something like a second honeymoon in the Highlands.
Correct. Their original marriage, they've only had one marriage. They were married in the Highlands and had their first honeymoon of sorts. I guess it was only like a 2-day thing, but their first honeymoon was also in the Highlands. So it seems like they're trying to get back to where they were, because they're basically starting over again, because they were separated shortly after they got married by the war. He was, again, you know, MI6, whatever, and she was doing her army nursing. So they were not together during that time.
And Frank is not only interested, I don't know if I'd use the word obsessed, but he's extremely interested in his family's genealogy. And we see this as several times where his meetings, or he tells stuff to Claire too when Claire's there at a meeting, one of the meetings with Reverend Wakefield.
Yes. I think that he's almost using the excuse of the second honeymoon to do more of his genealogical thing, because he seems to be way more interested in that than in rekindling their marriage.
He's definitely, to be frank, he is definitely interested in Claire. We see that clearly. Sexually, he loves her, all of that. They have that part of their marriage, at least what we see so far, is there. But as far as their relationship outside of that, he says he loves her. I believe he loves her. She loves him. But what is their marriage at this moment based on? Other than, I mean, they're married because they got married before. But I think that actually my inability to really speak about what we see between them is a good reflection of maybe what is between them, because they just got back together. Right. And so I think she does that well. If here as a reader, I am not really able to say much more than he loves her, she loves him, they're trying to rekindle or spend some time alone together after many years apart. And he's here spending that precious time before he takes on another post. Mm-hmm. He's here spending some of that precious time, a lot of it actually,
right,
with the Reverend. And I'm sure the Reverend's a sweet guy. He's great for taking on Roger and everything. But so that actually, I didn't think about that until now. That is actually the fact that I'm having trouble saying how I feel about how it's expressed that their relationship is, mm-hmm, might be a good reflection of how it actually is.
Well, she does write very specifically, so yes, that would definitely make sense.
Yeah.
But because this isn't my first time reading the book, this is one of like the hardest chapters for me to read. Just because you know something big is coming and you're just like, you just want to get
to
it.
You want to get through it.
So it's like, I almost hate saying this, but I almost feel like the first two chapters are like my penance, what I have to read to get to the story that I want to read.
But we were talking a little bit before we started recording, and Summer made a good point that this may be tongue in cheek, but the information that is shared with Claire, the information that she listens to, willingly, unwillingly, whatever, the information she gets from Frank and the Reverend, but they both tell part
of
it.
Which she was only half listening to, so she has an amazing recall.
Well, we will find. But the information that she at least was around and was meant to hear, because he was so excited about it, is, and this is where probably we get one of those little buzzer buttons, but we're not saying what happens, but it's just looking back and rereading it. So much happens in these two chapters that is, that yes, of course, sets it up, but also it's critical for her to know.
Yes.
So it's very...
I think it's... I'm not going to say it's not ironic. It was obviously intentional, but but looking back, it was good information for her to take back with her.
Mm-hmm. And some of that, not giving anything away, we're just listing things that she was told or that she learned. We learn about Frank's ancestor who served in the British Army, and he was stationed at Fort William. And one of them described him as on the dole of the Duke of Sandringham.
Yeah, they do mention the Duke of Sandringham.
So you have the Duke of Sandringham, who they say was a suspected Jacobite, and you have in the book they say he was, or Diana says he was suspected, and Frank or the Reverend, one of them mentions that Jonathan Randall was suspected to be on the dole of the Duke of Sandringham. So we have these names coming up, and they are just, it's just very good information that she is privy to before she takes a certain little journey.
Right.
So we have that, and also remember not just that it's his, all we can say right now is that she has the name and that she knows it's his, one of his ancestors. That's all that the book says right now.
But what I enjoy is the way that we kind of, and Frank does it, is the way that we kind of look back romantically at history. Mm-hmm. And he looks back at his family genealogy with such a romantic rose-tinted glass effect, where he sees, you know, Jonathan Wolverton Blackjack Randall as this like rakish, like I would imagine him being on the cover of a bodice ripper romance novel, the way that he's
like
being,
like a charming rogue,
right? The way that he's described by Frank, and the way that he's romanticized this character from his, not even a character, this relative of his from the past. Whereas, you know, when you go back and you actually look at the real history and the things that really happened, you know, it's not quite as rosy as you had romanticized it to be, without having all of the knowledge. But history does that in general. History has a way of...
Because people write history.
Right.
And history is never complete. The people who typically write, at least in history, it's usually the winners that write the history. Correct. And so you're not getting... In certain situations, you may get a better telling than others, but it's never a complete. And it's always through someone's eyes or through a group or through a certain culture's eyes. And it's always going to be colored.
Well, so it's also like people getting their history from like a journal, mm-hmm. a journal of somebody. Well, you know what? If you were going back in time and reading my journal that I wrote, I'm sure you would think that I was like this heroine who was out for the little man and always doing all these kind of things. But if you talk to somebody who didn't like me, they'd be like, she was mean and she was snarky and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, you can't really judge history based on a first person account. All the time.
I would say never. Probably. First person account, certainly not.
It's biased. I think it's my point.
All accounts are biased, but the good thing about first person accounts is that they, by definition, that person was, if it was a witness, that person was there. That person still has an axe to grind or still has a point to make.
Right.
So we, back to Claire and Frank. And we talked about this too, and I think we said we didn't hear much about Frank's family. We heard about his genealogy a little bit.
Correct.
But we did hear about Claire's family, and or not a ton, but she was basically an orphan. She was orphaned at five.
Yeah.
Her parents died in a car accident, and she went to live with her uncle Lamb. Who was
her only living relative.
Yes. And what's funny is I'm skipping over a little bit right here, but I had never thought about this before. So her parents died in a car crash. And then in the end of chapter 2, when she's describing whatever happens as she does something near or through or in or on, because we don't want to say too much yet because chapter 3 has not happened yet. But as she describes, I think as Diana puts it, entering or being in the center of chaos, something like that, and being turned inside out, and all of these beautiful descriptions that Diana used. In that, one of her descriptions is when she had felt when she was in a car crash. And I thought, I was reading her description, but I also thought, oh, a car crash she was in, and she was quite young. Well, I don't think she said her age in the car crash, but I immediately thought, I wonder if she was in the car with her parents, and if that was the car crash that her parents died in.
I mean, it's possible. The only reason I'm going to say to that is because she fell asleep in the passenger seat of a moving car. I doubt...
Typically, if parents are there, she would be in the back.
Correct. No, it could have been a bench seat, I guess, and then she could have been all three of them there. But...
Well, we don't know for sure, but it was just an interesting thought I had. I was curious. So, there are a lot of people... Well, we meet Mrs. Baird, mm-hmm. we meet the Reverend, we meet wee Roger. Roger is also an orphan, and his parents died, and he went to live with his great uncle. The Reverend says that the boy is his niece's son.
And she died in the Blitz, and her husband died in a plane. His plane disappeared.
So it would make... If that's his niece's son, then that would be his great uncle.
Correct.
So Roger lives with his great uncle, the Reverend, and we also meet Mrs. Graham a few times.
Yes.
once in bed sheets, once in not. No, we never meet her naked. She probably the most memorable scene with her was, of course, the tea leaves and the handmade.
Which, can I tell you, I wish I had someone in my life who just randomly had all these fun skills.
I know someone who does do tea leaf reading.
Like, did they learn it like from a book, or do they just...
No, it was, I think it's cultural. But yeah, so what are some of the things that Mrs. Graham mentions in the tea reading? And the tea, not so much. It was more the hand.
She said both. Like, she looked at her tea, and then she said, let me see your hands.
Because she was having a difficult time coming to...
Of course it was. If she was really good at reading tea leaves, and she was reading what was about to happen to Claire and the tea leaves, I would be looking for a second opinion.
It would have been,
I would have been like, I need something else here to look at.
All I'm saying is most of what she said she saw came from her reading the hand. probably because she couldn't see much in the leaves, or she wanted to get that second opinion and right. before she actually said something. But
again, and I mean, maybe that's giving stuff away too soon, but another really interesting skill that she's learned that she learns from someone before she heads back in time that comes up later.
That's true.
She said, oh, Miss Graham had this, she had this really funny statement that we both were reading together, like in separate books, and I chuckled out loud. And then like 10 minutes later, Ginger was like, what were you just laughing at? And then when I told her, she goes, yeah, I was totally laughing at that too. And what made me laugh was when she commented.
Oh yeah.
About when she works, at the church, I guess she says she reads palms at the church fetes, which I guess is like a party, party of sorts.
Or festival. Mm-hmm.
That she kind of pretends to look at the palm, but when she sees that she's got her, and what she says is her blouse cut down to her breakfast, mm-hmm. which the imagery of that like phrase elicited in my head made me laugh because
was that like a baby's breakfast?
Right. I was like, what breakfast? How low?
I guess would you constitute could say breakfast? A baby's breakfast or.
Ew, okay.
I don't know. Or someone else's breakfast.
Exactly.
Symbolically.
Correct. But we got a little chuckle out of that.
Without giving any spoilers away or attempting to, anyway, to perhaps the single most discussed part of any of the books or figure, and that is the ghost.
Yes, the ghost. And honestly, it's not really any spoilery to talk about it because the only reason that people know anything further about the ghost than what you get in this book is because Diana has mentioned it outside of the context of the books and that it would be something that would come back.
Yes.
And but so, it hasn't come back yet.
No, it has not come back yet in book 7.
No, we're not there yet. But she said
she's talked about it and she's referred to things about it. But we're not going to talk about that.
No.
But there is a ghost, and it's in there, and Frank talked about it, and so we can talk a little bit about it. So Frank is returning from one of his...
He went to meet someone off the top of my head.
When he's on his second honeymoon, supposed. So he's at a meeting, and he's coming back, and he sees this ghost. It's stormy outside because of the crackling of the air, the lightning, thunder lightning, that... Claire mentions she's having trouble with her hair. She uses L'Heure Bleue to
I really get it want to stay know what down. That smells like.
Me too. We should do like a, not a taste testing, a smell testing.
It sounds crazy expensive.
Well, maybe.
Because it's got a French name.
Almost everything has, so much has a French name.
Let's see if we can find it. Do they still make it?
That would be the first thing we have to see. We'll have to look into that.
Research.
So he sees, Frank can see Claire in the window as he's approaching the... in.
Yes.
And he remarks that it appears the ghost is also looking up at
Claire's window,
or at Claire. And what are some interesting things, briefly, how does he describe the ghost?
Dressed in full Highlander regalia.
Yep.
He describes him as, he has so much detail, and maybe this is the historian in him, but I just happened to see some dude standing on the street and I walked by him, I wouldn't notice a piece of jewelry he was wearing.
Yeah, especially if he's walking up, and this is just my brain, if this person or this ghost or this whoever is standing in front of a building and I'm approaching the building coming from behind the person or even from the side, isn't the brooch he discussed?
The running stag brooch.
Wasn't it on the front?
Yeah, I believe that you wore that on the front.
I could see that he had spent a lot of time or a few minutes or a lot of seconds seeing the back of him or the side of him.
But he only saw the front of him when the dude turned around and took off.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he must have an amazing memory, an amazing photographic memory to get that kind of detail from a dude, like, turning around and storming off.
And what else did he say about he said he saw the running stag brooch. He said he saw how he was dressed. Did he talk about his size? Did he talk about anything? I don't remember. His hair color? Was he wearing a wig?
Didn't he say
he
was like a big chap or something like that?
I think he said it was a biggish chap.
Big chap, he said.
A big chap. Okay, so he was a big chap.
And a Scot in complete Highland rig out.
So he thought he was a Scot. He was definitely in Highland regalia, and he was a good size. And didn't he say something about him not... He didn't appear happy. He wasn't mad, but maybe like a stern look? I don't seem to remember him saying the ghost looked wistful, but he was looking Maybe just
he
concentrating.
Said he seemed terribly unhappy about something.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so I don't think he was happy. Okay, so that's a little bit about the ghost. And then the ghost left, and after he left and Frank went up into the room, a few pages later, or a page or so later, we read something interesting. This says more about Frank. We talked about this earlier too. This, I think, on this reread, I'm looking into things a little bit differently, or more deeply. This, to me, says more about Frank, to us about Frank's character, is that he tells Claire about the ghost, or about the person, the figure he saw, and asks her if she had had any Scots, treated any Scots as a nurse during the war. And she said, well, yeah, I'm sure there were, you know, there were a lot.
She mentioned one.
Well, she mentioned one, but I'm sure there was more than one for her. But she said yes. And long story short, he basically came out of that. And what I got out of that entire conversation is that he was basically telling Claire, look, if you had an affair, I understand. It was wartime. I don't know why I went southern there. If you slept with someone, these were hard times. I could understand. Something happened. And if it happened, I forgive you. If it happened, I understand. I thought, or now reading it again, I'm thinking, he went straight from, did you know anyone? Did you treat anyone? To, if you slept with someone, I'll forgive you. And that makes me think, gosh, Frank, you're leaping awfully quickly. Is this your guilty conscience speaking?
Well, I was more concerned with the fact that he, to me, it seemed quite clear that he was implying that this dude was not real and it was a ghost.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was still all ready to accuse her of cheating on him.
Or he almost seemed like he was encouraging her to admit to something, period.
It was like he was trying to ease his own conscience.
That's kind of what I thought. And we did have a very kind listener sent us in a good number of potential comments and questions, or comments and potential questions, and that was her Twitter handle is Tweetly D, and she makes a very, I think, astute relationship. And now that we've discussed a little bit of Frank and a little bit of Claire, she says, it's hard to say exactly why, but I wouldn't say it's an equal relationship, speaking of Claire and Frank's relationship. It does seem that Frank's interests take a bit more of a front seat than Claire's, as you said, Summer, teaching at Oxford, visiting with the Reverend. I don't think Claire minds or cares. She is fairly self-sufficient, and she does go on her own to find the flowers, which we'll get to in a little bit. But I think Tweetly D is pretty much reflecting what we're saying.
I think that's straight on, but what I wonder is whether or not that is something that is more indicative of the time period.
Of his attitude?
And, yeah, and the traditional roles of men and women in the 1940s, as opposed to... Because, I mean, we're looking at it with 21st century sensibilities.
It's before the women's movement.
Right.
During the wars when women started heavily entering the workforce because of lack of...
Yeah, they had to.
Because they had to. But it was... I guess that was kind of the eventual beginning of women continuing to work and wanting to work and being able to have their own pay, etc. Yeah, this was definitely almost a few years before, but at the cusp of the modern era, but definitely before today's modern woman.
Right.
Before today's type of relationship. Do we want to now go into the Henge a little bit? Go into the Henge with Claire. Okay, so... Now to the stones. Claire goes to the stones three different times in these chapters. The first time is with
Mr. Crook. He takes her on a tour of shrubberies, apparently. And one of the places he takes her is to the Henge,
Craignadun.
Okay.
Craignadun.
Well, we'll all know once the Scots get a handle on it in the series. But he takes her up there, and she sees it and immediately goes, oh, I should bring Frank here.
Mm-hmm.
But then she gets home, and Frank's like, oh, we need to go get up early tomorrow morning because there's going to be witches out. And he takes her.
And hold on. Why is it? Why does he think or believe there's going to be witches? What day is it?
Beltane, I believe.
Which is what? May 1st.
Exactly.
Again, no spoilers here, but that's another thing you want to keep in mind. There's the date and the stones. That's it. Or just remember that there's something about the date and the stones. So
her intention was to take him back.
Yes.
And he ended up taking her there.
Yes.
Or them going together. But it was his idea to go to the exact same place because he'd heard that there was going to be some actual, you know, witchy festivities, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Or druidry, actually. But I loved this scene. I loved the imagery of all of these modern day women all dressed in bedsheets and out dancing and doing more ancient style things. And then at the end, they just put their clothes back on and they leave.
And something happens here, or it doesn't happen, I should say, that leads to Claire's coming back a third time. She sees some flowers, and when all the women leave, she and Frank get up, and Frank was going to show her parts of the circle, or they were looking around together. And she saw, if I'm not mistaken, she saw some flowers that she wanted to take or to get. And then there was a noise, and they could tell Frank got her quickly out of the way. One of the women was returning.
Correct.
And so they had to leave. They had to go hide again. And this made me... I laughed. I didn't tell you. But I was reading this. And this just made me laugh. I do not remember this. The woman who came back... She was the owner of the sweet shop.
Right.
She's the woman who came back... She sits back on the stones and just pulls out a cigarette. And I was like... Oh, I could just imagine Frank being so ticked off. Like, just waiting. Like, you're waiting for... Okay. I'm going to wait. Shush, shush. Be quiet just a minute. Wait till she comes and gets her little hair dilly bobber and then leaves. And then the person just sits up, takes off her jacket, and starts a cigarette. You're like, really? You know you're not going to get back in there anytime soon. So that was also kind of humorous. So yeah, she was not able to go back. She saw something, but she was not able to go actually take it, pluck it, or...
Careful.
Funny. So she goes, she can't do it, so she and Frank go away and and then she reminds, she gives the reader an example of how, but anyway, so she can't do what she wanted to do, so yet again the next day.
But this is what's funny, this is what's almost annoying about Frank, is that she says, oh, I need to get back up there. And he's like, yeah, you should. Go tomorrow. And while you're there, do this for me.
And why can't they go later that day? I guess they don't want... I don't know. Maybe they have something planned that Diana didn't tell us about. But yeah, she's going back the next morning with the intent of getting the flowers, or at least seeing them, and also looking for the fire, right?
Traces of fire.
So she goes up the next morning. And it's raining again. There had been a storm and she says she forgot to take a mac with her. I think it means like a raincoat. So she's soaked through and is looking for the traces of fire for Frank and looking for the flowers. She finds the flowers, and I also, although I've read this a number of times, I had never picked up on the type of flowers that she was considering it may have been. After the second trip... Or the first trip? The second trip. She's looking through her books, or some books, to try and identify the type of flower. And she rattles off a few names of families, I believe. And then she said, it might be a forget-me-not. And that's also a good point. I may or may not have picked up on it. Probably not. If Tweetly D, thank you so much, listener, had not mentioned that as well. She says... It's of interest to me that the flowers are likely forget-me-nots. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Let me go back and read that again. And I did. And she says, this family, although likely forget-me-nots. And I thought, that's, wow. So that's a little bit of is it too spoilery to say it's a little bit of foreshadowing? I guess.
The whole two chapters are foreshadowing.
Yeah. But we can't.
If you've read any book and you go back and read it again, the whole thing is foreshadowing because you know what's coming.
Or a lot of it is. But yeah, it was just very interesting. And I was glad that that our listener pointed that out, because I had never, ever considered the type of flower. It was just like, oh, doo-doo-doo, go and look for a flower. Oopsie. Stones scream. Ah! You know, that.
I can't wait to hear what a stone screaming sounds like.
Oh, seriously.
Because...
Seriously, that is...
Diana says it sounds much like a sort of scream you might expect from a stone.
Which is?
Horrible.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay. I want to know. I feel bad for the audio people. We need you to create a sound that might come from a stone.
Yeah, that's not challenging. Because they can just go talk to the neighborhood stone. But this... So this third trip, she goes for those two purposes. And... she's able to approach the stone to get the flowers or to look at the flowers without anything happening to her, correct? It's what was the thing that made her touch the stone?
She said there was a deep humming noise. Okay,
so she did hear a humming. She heard a humming and she thought it was bees or something. What made her touch it?
She touched it because she leaned. Okay. She leaned in to peer through the cleft to see if she could see what was humming. Okay. And that's when the stone screamed.
Okay. So she did. Okay. So she heard a noise. She leaned. She touched it as she leaned forward or through to see see if she could see something there. And it screamed and she backed up. And she almost fell.
So she did fall.
That's what I thought. She did fall.
And she sat down hard, as it were.
Yeah. She sat down hard, which is kind of like falling backwards. And then basically she kind of, in a way, it's a kind of a blackout. It does not say she fainted, but she was experiencing something really, really weird.
Well, she said her vision blurred, and then the rest of it, you know, was more, you know.
But it never said she passed out. No. It said she came back to herself down the hill somewhere. So she had been, when she came back to herself in her mind, she was still walking, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so if we don't have any evidence that she necessarily passed out because she wasn't down on the ground, she was still walking when she came back to herself. So she probably wandered around somewhere somehow, and that's all we know.
Though I do think that the last line of this chapter is so indicative of the person that Claire is. Hmm. In that it says, "The ring of inhuman violence was lacking, though. This was the sound of normal human conflict, and I turned toward it."
So hearing human conflict, she doesn't go, oopsie, see you later.
Right.
She goes towards it.
Exactly. So I think that's very indicative of the character of Claire. It says a lot about her.
And we will talk more about it in the next episode.
So for the next episode, yes. You guys, 3 and 4.
Chapters 3 and 4.
3 and 4. And as always, we welcome and invite listener comments, be that if you want to leave an audio comment or if you want to just, you know, shoot us an email or send us a comment on Facebook or even send us a tweet. Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been a very full episode.
I mean, I think it was a full episode like 15 minutes ago.
it's been quite full.
But I'm glad we didn't cut anything because Ailey was just so delightful.
She was a lot of fun, very sweet, very personable. And it was, I know I said this already, but it was a lot of fun. she was a lot of fun.
I think that's about all we have time for on this 6th episode of the Outlander podcast. Don't forget, next week we're continuing our read-along, chapters 3 and 4. I hope you join us.
Thank you again so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.